Thank you, Frédéric Pierucci, for welcoming us in your house. Catherine Austin-Fitz and the Solary Report asked me last year if I could read your book, The American Trap. It was during the first lockdown. It's not that I had much time to read, but I bought your book. And that was an experience, and a very moving experience. For our listeners, I'd like to say that your story is the story of a big company called Alstom. That's a very important one in France, in energy and electrical field. And you were a top manager in this company, and something terrible happened as April 2013, when you set foot in New York, in the airport. So Frédéric, can you tell us what happened in 2013 and what you were doing and in Alstom, what was your work then?
Sure. Thank you very much, Vanessa, and thank you very much for Catherine to give me the opportunity to give this interview. So, yes, I used to be a top executive of Alstom. Maybe just to put this in the global context, Alstom used to be one of the top French company. It used to belong to a much bigger group, which is called Alcatel-Alstom. So what we are doing in Alstom were mainly three things. We were manufacturing any kind of power plants, so hydro, nuclear, coal, wind, and so on. We are basically number two or number three in the world in terms of power generation manufacturer. Our competitors were mainly General Electric in the US, Siemens in Germany, and the Japanese and the Chinese. So that was the first leg. The second leg was we are doing any kind of transmission and distribution power equipment as well to, to transport the electricity. And the third leg, which is most known to the general public, is the transport division, where we are manufacturing metro cars and a high-speed train, like the TGV in France. Okay.
So then at that time, in which branch were you working?
So I was working in the power generation branch. The power generation branch was accounting for about half of the turnover of the company. Back in the beginning of 2010, the strategy of the group was the following. For the power generation activity, most of the new built power plant were going to be built in Asia, in India, China, Southeast Asia. So the strategy there was to partner with our Chinese competitor, which was called Shanghai Electric. And to make a big alliance between Alstom and this company to become the world number one player. So, and on the transport division, so the high-speed train and so on, the strategy of the group was to have an equity stake taken by a Russian company inside Alstom Transport to strengthen.
So the idea was to form an alliance with other big company on specific topics or projects.
Yes, well, on the global scale, in order to increase basically the value of the company. So when you look at the big picture, you know, you have a French company trying to team up with a Chinese company on the power generation, generation side, and with a Russian company on the transport division side. So there was somebody missing in the mix, and this and I will tell you what happened then. So for the power generation side, I worked for 22 years in this company, always in the power generation side. I was an expat most of my life. I spent one third of my career in Asia, China, Singapore, Beijing, Hong Kong. One third in the US and one third in Europe. I held a different position in the company, obviously. For a long time, I was a global head of sales for all the steam power generation equipment. So basically all the sale of very large coal-fired power plants or commercial island for nuclear power plants. So very, very large companies.
So you're an engineer, and at the same time, you have a financial and commercial background.
Yes, I have an MBA also from Columbia University in New York. So, at that time, I also had a different position in as a management of a global division of the group. So in 2012, I was heading what we call the boiler division. The boiler division was about 1.4 billion euro turnover, 4,000 people. And it had been decided by the CEO of the company that my division would be the test division in the merger with the Chinese.
Okay. So can I interrupt you just a second? Who was your chief CEO at that time? It was Patrick
Cron.
Cron. Okay, because yes. It's a figure that will be very important in the story to come. So yes. At that time, you were in a division that was testing this big alliance with the
Correct.
Chinese.
Okay. Correct. So Patrick Cron decided that in order to, before getting married, you're getting engaged, and in order to test the engagement, you know, we are going to basically carve out my division, and the Chinese would carve out their equivalent division, would put those two divisions in Singapore, and I would be heading the joint venture 50-50 between the two companies, and that would be the test for a bigger merger.
Can you tell us a bit about Patrick Cron, where he comes from? What's the, because as a French, yes. I know is a profile, but I think it's important for American audience to understand that is a. Is from a big engineer school.
Yes, he's from the top engineering school in France. They call it Polytechnique. So he had a remarkable career, and he joined Alstom in 2003 as a CEO of the company in a very difficult time, and basically managed to turn over the company. Was in the brink of bankruptcy in 2003 for other reasons. So back in 2012, he was still the CEO.
So it's been almost 10 years that he's on the position. So yes. What happened in April 14, 2013?
So as I said, I was for 2 years, I carved out all the units. I moved the headquarters of my division to Singapore because that was to be the headquarters of the new joint venture. So I arrived with my family in August 2012 in Singapore, and since I had a lot of people to manage in the US, or about 700 people in different sites in the US, in Chattanooga, in Tennessee, and in
700, you say?
Yes.
Okay, that's a lot of people.
Yeah, and in Connecticut. Mm-hmm. So I was flying back and forth from Singapore to the States about every 3 months, you know.
Okay.
In one of my business trip, in April 2013, when I arrived at JFK Airport, the door of the plane opened and I had five people from the FBI waiting for me.
Okay.
So, they told me I was under arrest. They handcuffed me at the door of the plane. They took me through JFK Airport like this. And they put me in a car and they sent me to FBI headquarters in Manhattan. So I had absolutely no clue why they were arresting me. They had no clue why they were arresting me. They just had the order to arrest me and to pick me up and to bring me to...
So they were following orders and they had no information. They didn't know...
I had no clue why they were arresting me.
That's
what they tell me, at least. Yeah, it was a shock because, you know, it's a very long flight from Singapore to New York. You know, I was exhausted. It was a Sunday night, 8 o'clock in the evening. So I was really exhausted. So big shock. So then they brought me to the FBI headquarters in Manhattan. And then I met with a prosecutor from the Department of Justice.
His name is David Novick.
David Novick. And basically, he told me the following. First of all, he told me that my company, Alstom, was under investigation from the Department of Justice for several years for different corruption cases that they were following throughout the world. That the company had decided not to cooperate with the Department of Justice, and I will come back later to explain what it means to cooperate with the Department of Justice, and that basically they had lost patience with the company, and that therefore they had decided to arrest me in order to give a big sign
Put pressure on Alstom, so
to the CEO of the company, but it was time to cooperate. So they told me that the goal was, of course, not to arrest me, but to go to the top of the company, to arrest the CEO of the company and to put him in jail for a long time for having organized a big corruption scheme throughout the world to win contracts, mainly against American companies.
So if I sum up, they say that Alstom is guilty of corruption acts.
Yes.
That they've been asking many requests and they've been asking many things to Alstom, but they haven't been cooperating with them.
Yes.
So to put pressure on Alstom, they decided to arrest you.
Yes.
And to go up to the top of Alstom with who at the time was Patrick Cron.
Yes. So okay. what basically they said, okay, the reason why they arrested me is that they said that 10 years back, so in 2003, 2004, Alstom won a contract in Indonesia. And at that time, Alstom had hired two consultants who, according to the Department of Justice, admitted to have paid bribes to Indonesian officials for Alstom to win the contracts. So at that time, I was the head of sales of this particular division who was doing this tender. So basically, they accused me of knowing that Alstom had hired those consultants, and they accused me that I should have known what was the ultimate goal of the payment of those consultants.
Mm-hmm.
But they were going to use part of their remuneration to pay bribes. So I will come back to this, but so they said that it's a concept of what they call willful blindness. Basically, you cannot put your head in the sand. If the company hire consultants to do whatever work, you have to know what they're going to do with their money, and it's your responsibility if at the end of the day they do something wrong with their money.
They're not accusing you of doing something. They're accusing you of not having done something to prevent the what they think is a corruption.
Yes, they accuse me of knowing that the ultimate goal of hiring those consultants was to pay bribes. As I said, okay, we know that there is no personal gain in this for you. We know that you had the processes inside the company and you were following the processes and so on. But nevertheless, you know, under American law, you know, you are an accomplice of the overall scheme.
And so what David Novick, the federal prosecutor, asked you to do, because I think it is very important.
Yeah.
What's the deal he suggests you?
So the deal is the following. Is basically he advised me not to call the French consulate, not to call the company. To inform them that I'm arrested, but basically to play the mole inside my own company.
Okay.
So you imagine, you know, you have a 24-hour flight almost. You know, you come to JFK, you are picked up by the feds. You know, you go to the FBI building, and then in 2 minutes, you have to decide whether you are going to play the mole inside your own company.
Well, it's like Grisham book, you know, this thriller where you're caught in the midst of something incredible and you have 2 minutes to decide your fate.
It's exactly this. So if you are brought in a French education and we ask you to play the mole inside your own company, you know, it doesn't work very well, you know. And also inside the company, we had processes to follow. You know, if something like this happened, you know, we had to call the general counsel of the company to seek advice and to inform him of what happened. So I refused.
Mm-hmm.
And I decided to call the general counsel of the company and the French
consulate.
It was midnight, you know, on a Sunday night. So I finally managed to get the general counsel of the company out of bed.
Mr. Carr.
Keith Carr. So he was shocked. He told me, "I don't understand what's happening, you know, because we are cooperating with the Department of Justice on this investigation. Mm-hmm. I'm just waking up to take a plane to go to Washington to what he thought was the final negotiation with the Department of Justice. So I was really surprised by the timing, you know.
Yes.
Basically, in fact, there are times my arrest to put maximum pressure on him for the following day, knowing that he was going to Washington to...
A lot of pressure for an appointment that's going to happen
yes.
next day. It's a bit too much.
So we arrest one of your top guy, and then you come to the table for negotiation. So obviously... it was huge pressure put on the company, and basically told me, okay, don't worry too much. Okay, we'll find you a top-notch lawyer. He's going to come tomorrow, because at midnight on Sunday night it's not possible, but he's going to come tomorrow. We are going to pay a bond, and you're going to be released on bail. And then we'll sort it out internally. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So the interesting thing to understand is that I realized much later that some people had played the mold inside the company. Some of the employees of the company.
Do you think they were Americans or French?
They were all Americans.
Okay.
The one I know, at least, they were all Americans. Yes. And it doesn't surprise me too much mm-hmm. when you think about it, because if you're American and you know the Department of Justice,
yes,
you know the power of the Department of Justice. I think people fear more the Department of Justice than anything else in the U.S. And so if you are brought up in the U.S. with the education of the Department of Justice, and you know that you know a lot of people end up in jail, I mean, mm-hmm. I just want to... remind you that the incarceration rate in the U.S. is 7 times higher than the one in France. So a lot of people in the U.S. know in their relatives, in their neighborhood, you know, people
someone
who go to jail.
In
France, it's very unusual to know somebody who...
Well, we don't put people in jail for civil cases. And also, Catherine, in one of the papers and videos, she will explain how the prison system in the U.S. have been...
Privatized. Yes.
In the 90s, and they make huge profits out of people
yes.
staying in jail for long periods.
Of course.
So I understand they will be afraid, but maybe they could have resigned from the company instead of being moles.
Well, you can't, because I mean the deal is of course you place a mole inside the company mm-hmm. against immunity or a much reduced sentence. Okay, so that's.
That's so better for them to stay in. And
so I understand that it's a lot of pressure as well, because some of the guys I know that they've played the most like this for more than 3 years in a row. So basically, it means that you go every day to the office, you know, with a mic under your shirt, you record everything.
It's not a life.
It's not a life. But also, you know, they coerce people into being more inside their company in exchange of immunity or relaxed sentence. So you understand that it's for an American citizen, it's complicated to say no to the DOJ.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's difficult for a French citizen to say no to the French Secret Service, or it's difficult for a Russian guy to say no to the FSB or the KGB, you know. So, but of course, if you are a foreigner, you come to the US and you have the prosecutor to ask you to play the mole for inside your company, you know.
But then it means you have to know it if you're a French company or any company, overseas company, not American, that if you're hiring American citizens in your company, you can be exposed to this kind
yes.
of thing. And so, yes.
Yes, because. Every country plays the same rules, you know. I mean, on China as well, you know, if you are Chinese, of course, you are under pressure from the Chinese government. So it's the same thing. But people tend to see it differently because it's the US, and that's no, it's always the same thing.
Okay.
So
there have been moles in your company. You're in jail. Basically.
So I spent the first night in jail, and then the next day, they pick me up and they bring me to Bridgeport in Connecticut to see the judge, not a judge, a magistrate who will decide on the next step, whether I was going to be released on bail or not. So then I meet with a lady who's been sent by the company to represent me.
Liz Latif.
Yes, so she's a young.
lawyer,
doesn't know anything about FCPA, which basically they accused me of breaching what they call the Foreign Corrupt Practice Act. Now we'll come back to this because this is...
Yes, the FCPA that dates back from 1977.
Right.
And has been reinforced in the 90s. Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
We'll,
So basically this lawyer doesn't know a thing about FCPA.
No.
She's just a young lawyer and she meets you for the first time.
Yes.
And, but you get information from her.
Yes, because she got a copy of the indictment, you know, but it's, you know, we cannot be in, even in the same room, so I cannot even see what was the indictment, you know. The interesting thing is that, in fact, I had been indicted 6 months prior to my arrival in the US. So I had been indicted in November 2012. So that's one of the also disadvantages of being a foreigner of in this kind of situation, because the Department of Justice considers that if you are a citizen of a country which, who does not extradite its citizen, mm-hmm. so it's like France, Greece, Germany, and so on, and you are indicted by the Department of Justice, they will keep your indictment sealed.
Secret.
Yeah, secret, sealed, and they're not going to put it in the open. So therefore, you are indicted, but you don't know you are indicted. So in fact, in a normal procedure in the US, you know, you arrive already at midway through the procedure because before that, you know, you had the grand jury, you had who decided to indict you and so on. Mm-hmm. But since we are foreigner, you don't know this. So you had no way to have a lawyer ahead of time to have discussion with the prosecutor to try to fight your case before the indictment. Here, you come already halfway through the process.
Mm-hmm.
They do that because they think that if you know that you are indicted, you are going to basically flee back to your home country and spend the rest of your life in your home country. So, for instance, a French guy will go back to France. And as long as he stays in France, you know, the France is not going to extradite
yes.
anybody to the US to be tried. So they keep it on the seal. So, but it's a big asymmetry already of treatment between.
Yeah, you don't have time in the way to build
you
up
prepare.
Your case and prepare for anything. You're just in jail, and you know that you've been indicted.
And in jail, you can't defend yourself when
no.
you're in jail, especially where I was. So basically, we go in front of the magistrate. We plead the case to be released on bail, and the magistrate decided not to release me on bail. Again, under the pressure of from the prosecutor.
So from pressure from the DRG?
But I said, same guy as I met before, the previous day, who basically says, okay, we cannot release Mr. Piocci because, you know, if we release him on bail, you know, even if we put him in an apartment with a guard 24-7, with electronic bracelet, with his passport taken, he could find a way to escape and go back to France. So basically, you are becoming James Bond the following day.
Well, actually,
you
know. It's what Carlos Ghosn did in Japan.
Yeah.
But you were not
right.
James Bond.
Right.
So, well, he wanted to put pressure on
so,
you.
Yes, and to show also to ALSA management that that they were going to treat me in a very tough way.
Right.
So, but this is the beginning of the nightmare because from the time you are, from the decision time of the judge to say, okay, you're not going to be released on bail, then put me in the squad team type of vehicle, you know, they put a chain around my ankle, chain around me, and they send me to a high security prison.
Yes.
In Wyatt, Rhode Island.
Wyatt Island, yes.
In Wyatt, you know, there are four levels of security prison in the U.S. that put me directly in the highest level of security. So there you end up with career criminals because, you know, you go to a place where those people have been there for a long, long time and they will spend also still a long, long time in prison. It's those prison, private free-run prison.
It's one of these prisons that was privatized in the 90s.
All the prisons I went to were privatized. So with all the system that I discovered later of trying to to keep the occupancy rate as high as possible. Yes. So yeah, it's like an more hotel. It's an hotel, well, except, you know,
it's the Auschwitz hotel, as Catherine says. Like, the more you stay, the more money you make for the owners. And so there's no incentive to release people.
No, it's the opposite. It's hotel, yes. It's Hotel California. You check in, but you don't know when you go out, you know? And they keep you as long as possible, because it's part of the...
And there was no necessity for you to be in this kind of jail, since you hadn't...
Well, you end up with career criminals, so you end up with the big shot of the East Coast of the U.S., you know?
What kind of... welcome you got.
Well, happened? I don't understand why you're there.
Okay.
So very quickly, it's very complicated, this environment in U.S. prisons, because you have a lot of suspicions among prisoners.
Of course.
Because you have snitches, you have a pedophile, you have a rapist, you have whatever you have. So you don't want to say too much about your case to the other prisoners, mm-hmm. but you need to say enough not to be categorized as a pedophile, because because then it's a snitch. it's a difficult balance. The conditions are, as you can imagine, not good at all. It's a dorm, 54 people in a dorm with a light 24/7.
Light 24/7?
Yeah, with toilets with no doors, no walls, no nothing. So you have
no privacy at all.
No, you have five toilets next to each other, you know. Same thing with showers, you know. And a small courtyard. But for a long, long time, for more than 9 months, I was not able to go to the courtyard.
So you didn't go out for 9 months?
Yeah, yeah. So when I arrived there, I tried to, first of all, get somebody from Alstom to come to visit me.
Mm-hmm.
As you can imagine, there are not so many volunteers to come and visit
Very
me.
Very courageous.
well, in fact, they issued a note, the top management issued a note the following day of my arrest, basically forbidding anybody to come to go to...
So they say, we don't contact you anymore. Alstom said, no contact anymore.
No, they said to their own employees not to go to the U.S.
Okay.
Of course, they also said to their employees not to contact me. Or my family,
mm-hmm.
So except one person in Singapore where my family was staying. Then what happened is that I tried to get to talk to the lawyer that I had appointed to do for me. Okay, so basically legislative boss. So he came to visit me a little bit later.
Mm-hmm. Stan Twardy
was ex-attorney general of Connecticut, so he used to be on the other side of the fence.
A former attorney, prosecutor himself.
Yes.
Okay.
So top-notch lawyer. One of the big problems, and I realized it much much later, is that there was a huge conflict of interest.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you are arrested like this, basically there's a huge conflict of interest between you and the company. Why?
Mm-hmm.
Simple. I was arrested. What I wanted to gather was the following. I wanted to gather organization chart dating back to the time of the case, you know, 2003, 2004, to show what was my role inside the company.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to get copies of all the internal procedures at that time, especially the procedures to hire agents and consultants.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, we had a very heavy procedure who needed 13 signatures in order to appoint.
People were involved?
Of course, because all the departments of the company were involved to select the consultant, to write the agreement, so basically we had legal, we had compliance people, we had financial people, we had the sales people, we had top management. So basically you had a very, at least on paper, solid process to hire any consultant,
mm-hmm.
and then to pay the consultant. So there is a big conflict of interest between the company and the person who's just been arrested. because as a person who has just been arrested, what I wanted to do, I wanted to gather a lot of information about, first of all, I wanted to have organization charts of how the company was organized back in 2003, 2004, 2005, to show what was my role and who were making decisions above me for hiring and paying consultants. So then I wanted to have copies of all the internal procedures showing how consultants were basically signed on by the company, retained. So at that time, we had at least on paper what we thought was a robust process, needed 13 signatures from a compliance department, legal, financial, up to the N-1, two person at N-1 to the CEO, we are supposed to approve the hiring of any consultants and the payment of any consultants.
But let me interrupt you. Of course, there are conflicts of interest because the interest of the company is to show that they are clean.
It's not exactly this. No, because they're not at the point where they want to be to show that they are clean. So I want to gather this information to defend myself.
Yes.
Okay. And I wanted also copies of all the emails exchanged by everybody at that time, showing who had decided what. Okay. Mm-hmm. If you're on the side of the company, what you don't want to give any ammunition to the guy who's just been arrested, who are going to point finger at other people inside the company who are not arrested.
Okay.
Okay. So that's why there is this conflict of interest. So therefore, as a CEO of the company, you want to protect your company and you want to protect, of course, the people still working in the company, not arrested. Therefore, you're not going to give any emails to the guys who've been arrested to defend himself, who are going to point fingers at people higher up in the hierarchy who are still inside the company or not arrested.
And if I'm correct, you realize then that the DRG has been after Alstom since 2010?
Even before.
So it's been a couple of years that Alstom and Patrick Cron are aware that the DRG are onto them. And if I'm correct and recall well, you realize that your case is not important to the DOG. What is important for them is to have a grab on Alstom.
Yes, but I realize it much later, you know.
Yes, but I think we could go to this.
Yes.
To this time because that's the way things. You understand that you are the heart.
Yes.
Of a financial and economic grab onto Alstom. Can you tell us when this happened?
This happened a little bit later because what I had to do, basically after 4.5 months in this high security prison, I had to plead guilty. Okay.
Till then, you played non guilty.
Guilty. But then you have the prosecutor who's telling you the following: look, Mr. Piacci, you have two choices. Either you decide to go to trial, and if you decide to go to trial, we are going to give to your lawyer all the documents that we have collected against your company, Alstom, throughout the world during the course of the investigation. So the first batch, we're going to give to your lawyer 1.5 million documents. So it's emails that, you know, every NSA, CIA, everybody has you know, grabbed everywhere in the world. My lawyer told me, okay, just to look at the 1.5 million first batch documents is going to take 3 years. It's going to cost between $5 and $10 million. And during these 3 years, you stay in this high security prison because I asked to be released on bail several times. I refused all the time.
All the time. Every time they refused. You had to stay in security prison.
Okay. So you can't defend yourself when you stay in a dorm with 54 people, you know, and you have a limited access to documents. So, if you follow that path, then we're going to take 12 people from the street. We're going to call them a jury, you know. We're going to present the case against you. We're going to explain that a French company paid some bribes in order to win a contract against an American company. You have zero chance to win such a trial. And if you lose this trial, then we're going to sentence you. And in order to sentence you, we have a very nice book, which is called U.S. Sentencing Guidelines book. People in the US are probably more familiar than the French people with this book.
It's coming in France, yes.
But this, basically, this, for infringement of the FCPA, the prison time, the sentence for the individual, is calculated based on the profit made by the company on the projects. So even if you have no personal gain return, it doesn't even come into the equation. So they told me that if I lose a trial, the sentence range that the judge will have to sentence me to is between 15 and 19 years.
It's the minimum.
It's a range, it's a bracket, okay, according to the book.
Plus...
So that's first line of defense, okay? Second line of defense, you don't look at the documents that were governed against the company, and you just plead guilty, okay? And if you plead guilty, we promise you, we're not going to put it in writing, but we promised you that you will be out in 6 months.
Okay.
And this is a deal between you and between the prosecutor and the and your attorney, your lawyer.
So if I remember, it's an open deal or something
that.
Open deal.
Yeah,
it's not in writing, but the prosecutor say, okay, look, if you plead guilty in 6 months' time, you're released.
Yes.
Okay.
So therefore, after having discussed at length with the lawyer, I decided to plead guilty. What you have to know is that in the US, because of this system now, which is basically based on negotiation only, and negotiation where the person who has been indicted has no power at all. You know, it's a one-way mm-hmm. negotiation. Out of 100 people who are indicted, 90 plead guilty without going to trial. So only 10% of the people who are indicted go to trial, and out of them, 8.5 loses. So you have what we call a conviction rate in the US of 98.5%.
Yes,
which is equivalent.
They boast off this conviction rate, which is actually it's just asymmetric forces. So there's no negotiation.
Yes.
Or you say yes, or you spend up your
yes.
rest of your life in jail, basically.
Yes, and a lot of people spend a lot of time in
jail. And if you don't have the financial means to have
a
defense, okay.
That's
so
right.
When is it that you understand that they want to keep you in jail? They promise you things to...
Yes.
To give hope, but it's not
what
happening. And you understand that what they're after is outcome.
Much later, after 6 months, I'm not released. So
okay.
then I wonder why I'm not released. So I ask my lawyer, you made a deal with the prosecutor. They don't want to release me. And he said, yes, first time it happened to me in my 40 years career in Connecticut, you know. Usually, not usually, all the time when there's a verbal agreement like this, you know, they honor the agreement. Here, they don't want to honor it, and I don't know why.
But, okay, so he's being frank.
No, he's not being frank, but that, because I think he knew why, but, you know, he didn't tell me. Because, in fact, one of the problems I had is that my lawyer had been appointed by the lawyer who was defending Alstom in the same case. And he was paid by the lawyer who was defending Alstom in the same case.
Don't conflict of interest again.
Huge conflict of interest because, I mean, of course, we don't want the same thing at that point in time. So my view is that he should never have accepted the mandate to defend me knowing that he was paid by the lawyer who was defending Alstom. Okay, so, but that I didn't understand it at the beginning, you know. I realized it much, much later. So that was another big mistake for me because... At the end of the day, I didn't have a lawyer who was fighting for my case, okay? He had huge conflict.
Well, you were in the fog, and see islands and obstacles as you go in the
exactly.
way. So
exactly.
It's not a mistake. It's you can understand when things happen. Before it's difficult to...
Before it's difficult. And I was quite happy that the company was paying for a lawyer for me. So,
it makes sense too, because it's a company you work. They're paying for your defense. You don't know exactly what the stakes are. But the turning point for me is you realize they're after us.
Then it's a problem. Then I don't understand for another 4 months what happened. Between month 6 and month 10, I don't understand what's happening. And really, it's very confusing. And then... I see on TV, you know, one day that GE is buying Alstom.
So when was it exactly?
It was February 2014. Okay.
So it's almost
almost a year.
So you watch TV in prison?
I watch TV in prison, and then I watch CNN, and then you have this announcement coming from Bloomberg and so on. And then everything became very clear to me. Okay. And then I confronted my lawyer. Okay, I said, okay, now I understand why I'm here. You know, the company wants to, well, the DOJ is using me basically as a weapon to put pressure on
as a blackmail.
As a blackmail, G is in the loop, and so on and so forth.
So I like to stop here because I know the rest of the story, but I think it's important to say now that the DOJ was after Patrick Kron, who was the CEO of Alstom. Patrick Kron was very afraid that he might
end up in jail for
end up
time.
In jail like you.
Yes.
So he had a lot of pressure, and the deal was okay. GE wants Alstom.
Yes.
Akron agrees to sell Alstom to GE.
Yes, and there's no pursuit against him.
And no pursuit against him.
Yes.
So what about you in the process?
Well, basically, they keep me in prison to put maximum pressure on everybody until the deal is done. So February, you have the announcement. By the way, Kron comes to the U.S. In Chicago, you know, to at the General Assembly of GE to make the final deal with Jeff Immelt.
Mm-hmm.
He's not arrested. Okay, so while I'm in jail, he's in the U.S., you know, with...
Jeff Immelt is the CEO of GE.
Yes.
It's been all his career I've looked at it was in GE. Patrick Kron comes to the
U.S.
To the U.S.
Chicago.
Chicago at the General Assembly of GE. They make the deal.
Yes.
You are in jail.
Yes. And he's not arrested. Okay.
Okay.
He can fly
freely.
No problem. Okay. They make the deal, and then on his way back from the U.S., you have a leak from Bloomberg who's saying that basically Kron is selling Alstom to GE. Okay, the two-thirds of the company to GE. So as soon as he lands in Paris, he's summoned by the Minister of Economy, Mr.
Arnaud Montebourg.
Right from the Le Bourget directly to
yes, Montebourg for our listeners was then the Minister
of Finance of Economy.
Economy. So he was in charge of the economic interest of France.
Yes.
It was under Hollande presidency. It was a left-wing government.
Yes.
I'd say Montebourg is a socialist, but more like center-left.
Yes.
And he was really into
reindustrializing, yes.
Actually, I met Arnaud Montebourg two or three times in just by coincidence, and we exchanged a bit about his projects.
Yes.
That was after he resigned. And so Montebourg is informed of this deal. And what his reaction is?
He's furious because Alstom is the jewel of the crown in the big French companies. Alstom Power Generation has built all the turbines for all the nuclear power plants in France.
So it's a key activity.
It's a key strategic asset. You know, in France, in order to be independent from oil, we embarked in a big plan in the 60s and 70s to build all nuclear power plants in France. So basically, nuclear power plants in France produce 75% of the electricity in France. It's the only country where you have such a dominant part of nuclear energy in order to be independent from the oil country.
It was De Gaulle.
It was De Gaulle and
strategy.
Yes.
And then in the 70s, we have nuclear plants who are independent on the energetic side. So it basically means France is losing a big company, a very important one, and a strategic assets. They're both,
exactly,
things at the same time. So if I recall well, Montebourg resigns.
Well, Montebourg, first of all, tried to fight.
Yes.
Tries to either kill the deal with GE or find an alternative with Siemens, the Germans, at least so that we make a European deal with our German competitor.
Yeah, because sorry to interrupt you again.
Yes.
I remember from the press, because at that time I saw the case from the press, the argument was that Alstom was in dire financial state, needed partners, and it was absolutely necessary to go with GE, and Montebourg was looking for another partner like Siemens with the German, which is this German equivalent.
Yeah, which is what they try to sell to the general public, you know, because a few months earlier they were saying completely the opposite, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They were saying the strategy was the strategy I described before. And then all of a sudden, you know, Alstom is becoming a bad apple, you know,
and you have to sell it.
And you have to sell it. So of course, Monbo doesn't buy it. Nobody buys it. But at the end of the day, he's trying to make to build up a counter offer. He understands that this sale is linked to the judicial problem of Alstom in the U.S. Mm-hmm. He makes the links between the
what's happening in the US
with, against the company. He makes the links with my case. I don't know how he makes it, but he makes the link. He tries to contacts my wife, mm-hmm. you know, to try to understand this. Of course, I'm in jail, so it's complicated for me because I'm in the dark. You know, I was supposed to be released after 6 months. I'm still there after a year. You know. And I have no clue when I'm going to be released, you know. Mm-hmm. So, but he understands the whole picture. He tries to fight it. But at the end of the day, the French government decides that it's GE is buying the company. So it's
in June. And who is at the French government then?
It's Valls as prime minister and Hollande as president.
Okay.
Okay. So they decide to in favor of General Electric. So during all that time, they keep me in jail to put maximum pressure, and they release me the week that the French government decide that the General Electric and not Siemens was buying Alstom after 14 months in this high security.
So you've been 14 months in a high security jail,
yes.
And they release you after the deal is done.
Yes,
and in this during this time. Any of your family or friends had contacts with Alstom or
just my wife. Just my wife has contact at the beginning with the people in Singapore where we are. She asked for a meeting with Patrick Rouen in August 2013, so just after a few months after my incarceration, and he cancelled the meeting just the day before. So so she's not even able to meet with him.
Okay, and since then, since you're back in France,
they stop all discussion with my wife. At the beginning, they have some discussion, and then they stop all the discussion. Mm-hmm. So when they release me, I'm not sentenced, so they release me on bail. So they accept to release me on bail. And they ask me to put a bond of $1.5 million. So I don't have $1.5 million. I ask, in fact, that two American people put their house as a collateral. Yeah. So by miracle.
Which is a sign of high trust in you. And,
yes, I could not never thank enough my American friends who put their house as a collateral for the bond, because otherwise I was probably still in jail. So they release me. In June, then for 3 months I have to stay in the US. Mm-hmm. And then after 3 months, I can come back to France, but still not sentenced, still on bail.
Okay.
Normally in the US system, once you plead guilty or you are found guilty at trial, then 3 months later you have your sentence maximum.
Oh, so they're hanging on this sentence?
Yes.
So you're there's no judgment. So
there's no judgment.
You're it's like forever being on
yes.
bail.
Yes. Yes. And I come back to France. When I come to France, I have very rapidly a meeting with the Ministry of Economy, with the people in charge of economic intelligence then, who understood the complete scheme. Mm-hmm. But they could have done nothing. In their papers, they call me the economic hostage. But they say, okay, politically, they could not do anything. So what I did during those 14 months, what I did is that I studied all the cases of FCPA,
the Foreign Corruption
Practice Act. So I asked my family to send me all the documents they could find, all the indictments, all the plea agreement, and so on from all the companies, all the individuals. And I studied this for 14 months, from 8 o'clock in the morning to 8 o'clock in the evening, because I wanted to understand this law and I wanted to basically try to find inside the cases, things that could help my case, okay?
Yeah, understand how it works and
yeah,
how it could work.
Jurisprudence, find some...
And what did you find?
And it's very interesting when you study this in detail, you can see the big picture out of this. So when I came back to France, I said, look, Alstom is not the first company. We had already Total, Technip, Alcatel, through the same thing.
For American listeners, Total, Technip, Alcatel are also jewels, very yes. big company and key area.
Total is the equivalent of ExxonMobil, you know. Technip is a big
engineering platform
builder, and so on. Alcatel is a big telecom company. All of them already went through the FCPA indictment type of thing, you know, with the Department of Justice. All of them were destabilized. All of them paid a huge fine.
Paid huge fines.
And so on. And now Alstom, they went even further, because not only Alstom would have to pay a fine, but then would be dismantled. So we are back in September 2014. So I start to talk to one of the big French lawyer to say, look at all the information I've gathered on the FCPA and how this is used as an economic weapon to destabilize basically European companies. And I said, we have to react. And with him, we did quite a lot of lobbying in France, you know, to change the law. We organized, for instance, a conference at the French Parliament, mm-hmm. Which was named after Alstom, Who's Next?
Who's next left?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, there's not many companies left.
And the idea was to have a panel of specialists who to explain to the member of Parliament how this was used and what should be done to counteract this law. So maybe we can explain it a bit, what is the law, what is the FCPA?
Yes.
Okay. The FCPA is a law which was enacted in 1977. Why? What happened in 1977 was that you just after the Watergate, and you have Carter now who's the president. And then you have a big scandal involving Lockheed Martin. Lockheed Martin is a big American company who was manufacturing military aircraft, F-16, F-35, and so on. And at that time, Lockheed Martin admits that he had paid bribes throughout the world to sell its military aircraft against European competition. So they admitted to have paid 1 million bribes to the prince consort in Holland, in Japan, everywhere in the world. So huge scandal in the US. And then Carter has to make a decision. You know, either he criminalizes corruption. Okay, so or he allows American company to bribe. At that time, in Europe, in Japan, in fact, the companies were allowed to bribe by their government, meaning that every year, for instance, the French company were going to the French Ministry of Finance to declare the bribes that they had paid overseas.
Yeah, intermediary fees.
Yes, and then it was deductible from the tax import. Yes, from the tax on the company.
It was tax deductible.
Yes, like a normal expense. Mm-hmm. But you had to justify it and to declare it once a year at the French Ministry of Finance. So. Basically, because you are just after the Watergate, so Carter decides that he has to penalize corruption. So, therefore, the U.S. enacts this first law, anti-corruption, the Foreign Corrupt Practice Act, which basically forbids American company to pay bribe overseas to public officials. Mm-hmm. So, of course, this creates an asymmetry between
distortion of competition
between American companies and their European and Japanese competitors. So, therefore, the American companies, for during all that time, during almost 25 years, they put pressure on Congress, on everybody, on DOJ, and so on, basically not to use the law. And if you look between 1977 and 2000, you have only one or two cases per year, very small cases, very small company, very small fines. So basically, the big U.S. companies have managed to not to be sanctioned by the Department of Justice for this. So they have a law, but they don't apply it. But then comes the end of the 90s.
It's under Clinton.
So it's under Clinton. So what happened in the 90s? First of all, you have the collapse of the Soviet Union.
Yes, in
1991. So then what happened because of the collapse of the Soviet Union, the end of history, as you remember, this is some some people said, okay, you have all the secret service in the US who have nothing to do.
They're not.
They have lost their purpose for 50 years. They have tried to destabilize every, well, to fight
Russia.
Russia and communism everywhere in the world, and socialism everywhere in the world. And now they have no more enemy. So Clinton decides to reorientate basically the Secret Service from a political purpose to economic purpose.
Okay, that so in the 90s, you're shifting, it's for economic purpose. We're using the information and intelligence to the economy.
Yeah, to use the economy. And this is very well documented in the US. And second thing, you have some clever people in the US who said, okay, now we've got this FCPA law who does not help us, okay? Because we still have this distortion of competition with our European friends and Japanese friends. So let's try to do something clever. So they did two things. First of all, they changed the law in 98 by making it extraterritorial. So before 98, the law applies only to US companies. After 98, it applies to any company in the world as long as you have the smallest link with the US territory.
What kind of links?
Alors, so they use two type of canals to have jurisdiction. First way is to use the canal of the dollar. They say that as long as you have a contract labeled in dollar, at one point in time in the process, you need to have a clearing bank in the US. So therefore, you have a link to the US territory. So they say, at that time, every contract using dollar is under U.S. law, under U.S. FCPA.
Okay.
So since you have 70% of the transactions in the world were in U.S. dollar, you know, it brings a lot of contracts under company under the FCPA law. Second canal is a canal of the internet and the GAFAM. And basically, I say, as soon as you have an email exchange who is routed or is stored in the on U.S. servers, you know, same thing, you have a link with U.S. territory. So, for instance, they give a big fine to a Hungarian company who paid a bribe in Montenegro, in Europe, in euro. But since the CEO sent two emails who were routed through U.S. server, they went after the company and they made the company pay the $50 million.
So basically, if I want to avoid being under the FCPA, I'll never exchange in dollar. I'll never write a contract in U.S. dollars or with U.S. reference. And I don't do any exchange through internet.
That's what the Russians and the Chinese are building.
Okay.
They are building an alternative to the SWIFT system, and they are building their own infrastructure to de-link their internet with the rest. Okay, and for instance, in China, they have a big plan to de-Americanize all the computers used by the administration and then by the
Because software I use on the computer is from Microsoft, so if there's a backdoor or something, then I
So therefore, you have you have all this. So, 98, they changed the law, they make it extraterritorial. So it means now everybody, basically almost everybody in the world is under US law. And third step, they put pressure on OECD. So that, in 98, you have the anti-bribery, Act of the OCDE, who basically impose that all the countries of belonging to OCDE have to put in their national law an anti-corruption law. So therefore, from 2000, all 40 countries of belonging to OECD, basically, they can no longer pay bribes.
Okay.
So then the final nail in the coffin is coming with the Patriot Act, which gives a lot of ammunition to the NSA and so on.
Patriot Act was after 2001.
Just yes. after September 9/11 and so on. Who gives a lot of ammunition to the NSA and the Secret Service, basically to do spying on a very, very large scale, and especially economic spying, which was then revealed by Snowden and WikiLeaks later. So when you have all of those pieces of the puzzles coming into place, then they start to apply the FCPA, the Department of Justice. Mm-hmm. So for instance, in 2005, the FCPA, the Department, the Treasury in the US was collecting only $10 million total fine for FCPA infringement. Last year, it was $3 billion.
Whoa.
Okay, so you have an exponential use of the FCPA once it becomes extraterritorial. So since I had a lot of time to study this, you know, it's I'm an engineer, I like to count. So when you count, I looked at, for instance, all the companies who paid more than $100 million fine to the US Treasury for infringement of the FCPA. And when you see this, you see that only 20% of the fines are paid by American company. 80% of the fines are paid by non-American companies.
By overseas companies.
And mainly the two-thirds by European companies.
Okay.
Okay, so French, German, British, Italian, Swedish, Norwegian, and so on.
So can we say that instead of looting the country, like in old times, like barbarian times, you know, around the Mediterranean Sea, you go... On either side of the Mediterranean Sea, you go, you do a razzia, set fire, and they come back to your land with gold, jewels, and some women. So instead of doing that, they use UFCPA.
It's much more clever because then you use the law. So basically, you use the law as an economic weapon. You do it on the non-questionable moral grounds. Everybody wants to fight corruption, so of course. You hide it behind this, and then you start to target a specific sector. So they started to target, you know, oil and gas, energy, telecom, and so on. So that's why you have Total in France, you have Eni in Italy, you have Statoil in Norway, all oil and gas companies. Then you have telecom company. You have Alcatel in France, you have Ericsson, you have Hanover, Deutsche Telekom, you know, started to be targeted by the Department of Justice. On the energy side, you have Alstom, you have Siemens in Germany,
you have
Hitachi, then you have banks and so on.
And when they come in, like if you're... If the DOJ is after you, they have access to your files. They have send an expert or auditor.
It's not even this. It's that the DOJ, if you are under investigation by the Department of Justice for infringement of the FCPA or any other laws, because the FCPA is just one of the extraterritorial laws that the US is using, they ask for the company to cooperate. Mm-hmm. Okay, so what does that mean, cooperate? It means that you have to hire an American law firm, mm-hmm. one of the law firm that the DOJ trusts. You have to pay this law firm to do an internal investigation inside your company. And this investigation, you know, you have to give the parameter at the beginning, so geographical parameters. Most of the investigation, it's worldwide. And then you have to give a time limitation. Usually it's 5 years. It could be more than 5 years. And then this law firm comes inside your company and is going to look at all the emails, all the economic transactions of the company. They are going to look at all the consultants that you have hired everywhere in the world. And so they're going to use forensic experts to do that. And basically, you as a company, you pay this law firm to do an investigation against you. And then once you've done the total investigation, it could take 1 year, 2 years. Then you go back to the Department of Justice in Washington and you tell them what you have found. And you have to start your presentation to the Department of Justice by saying, who are the people inside your company who have been doing something wrong? So you have to denounce your own employees. You have to tell them which contract you have won using bribes, mm-hmm. using what intermediary, you know, percentage paid, you know, who are the people then who have been bribed, what is the value of the contract you have won, what is the margin you have made on those contracts, and then if you are honest with them, then they will use a mathematical formula and they will tell you the fine that you have to pay to them. Mm-hmm. That's if everything goes well, okay? And if you don't do that, it means you're not cooperating.
Okay. And then what happened?
Then they start to go after people, you know, to push put the CEO to under pressure to fully cooperate. So if you look at in about 75% of the FCPA cases, basically the company, nobody goes to jail. Okay. Mm-hmm. Only 25% of the cases you have people go to jail because the company was not cooperating at the beginning. Of course, they don't say this. The theory is that if you cooperate, you know, we still can go after the executive and mm-hmm. so on. But in practice, you know, when you look at the fact, that's what happened. So basically, in all the cases above $100 million paid, you have 2/3 paid by a European company in all strategic sectors. So they started with the easy to get sector and the more strategic sector like telecom, mm-hmm. energy, and so on. But now it's open bar; it's any sector. Sometimes you have U.S. companies still in this list, and when you look at it, because I mm-hmm. was wondering why are they going after some U.S. company, you realize that they go after U.S. company when the investigation against those U.S. companies starts outside of the U.S. For instance, you have Halliburton, Kellogg Morland Root, who is on the list. You have Alcoa, who is on the list, and so on. But you realize that, in fact, it's because the investigation started outside of the U.S. and therefore the U.S. did not want local authorities to go after Halliburton. Okay, then they ask those cases to be transfer the cases in the U.S. and therefore they had to deal with those cases.
Well, it's more like a protection for their own U.S. companies,
yes.
and real cases.
Yes. So. That's the big picture. So if I come back to my story, so what we try to do in order to counteract this is that we created our own anti-corruption law, basically to go against our own company. Because before 2015, you know, we had a law, but it was not really applied as I told you. So, in 2016, we created the Sapin II law in France, who imposed to all the French companies above a certain size to put in place anti-corruption processes. So with my company, Icarion, we are helping French companies basically to build their anti-corruption system. Mm-hmm. So we do a lot of training. We do a risk map for them. We developed some tools which are not American tools, you know, on compliance, like a whistleblowing hotline, like a due diligence, a screening of your partners consultants or suppliers and so on, in order to raise the level of compliance inside the French company,
which is a way to protect themselves from the FCPA.
It's one way.
If you show that you're applying, you're compliant with the local rulings on the corruption.
Yes, and we've put very high standard in France, mm-hmm. you know. So that's one way. The other way was to find a way to settle cases of French company who had paid bribes, you know, in France, so that the fines would be paid to the French treasury instead of being paid to the U.S. treasury. Mm-hmm. So for that, we have created in France a mechanism. It's called Convention Judiciaire d'Interprétation. It's the equivalent of what in the U.S. we call a deferred prosecution agreement. Mm-hmm. Because in the U.S., if a U.S. company is targeted by the Department of Justice under the FCPA, he has the opportunity to negotiate with the Department of Justice what we call a deferred prosecution agreement. It means
deferred prosecution agreement.
Yeah, it means the company admits the wrongdoing, pay a fine, but there's no conviction of the company.
Okay.
So they're not excluded from public market.
Okay.
Okay. So in Europe, we did not have this kind of, at least in France, we did not have this kind of negotiated deals with the prosecution. So that's therefore, now we have implemented this also in France, which helped us to basically get back in the last 2 years, $2.5 billion fines, which otherwise would have been paid to the US.
Wow, it's a big number.
It's a big number. In fact, in the last 10 years, between 2010 and 2020, French companies paid $14 billion fine to the U.S. Treasury for infringement of different U.S. extraterritorial laws. 2.5 for FCPA and the rest for other laws. Because you have other extraterritorial laws.
Yes.
For instance, you have the law regarding export control and embargoes. You know, if you breach embargoes decreed by the U.S., you know, you are basically coming under U.S. law and they can be prosecuted by the U.S. So that's what happened to BNP Paribas in France or to Société Générale, who paid big fines to the U.S. because they had breached
The embargo
decreed by the U.S. You have also an export control. They consider that if you're using components manufactured in the U.S., you're not allowed to export it wherever you want. But the biggest, the most worrying extraterritorial law is the CLOUD Act, which was enacted in 2018. Because this is the paroxysm of extraterritoriality. I just want to maybe say a few words on this. As you remember, in 2013, we had Edward Snowden, who put to the world what the NSA was doing. And basically what he was saying is that the NSA were basically collecting all...
Was spying on us all?
On all us all, were collecting all emails, voicemail, SMS, exchanged by everybody around the world. They had a specific section regarding economic spying, where there were and political spying. So you know what they put, they were listening to Angela Merkel, to President Hollande, and so on. But also that they were spying on European companies. And part of the thing that he revealed was that through the project called PRISM, they were monitoring all contracts above $200 million followed by French companies. So meaning that all the executives in big French companies were negotiating those kind of contracts were under NSA scrutiny. So of course it gives you a big advantage when you are competing with those companies. So but Snowden revealed it to the world, and he revealed also that more than 100 companies in the US were basically partnering hands in hand with the NSA to do this. You had a big partnership between public and private, and the private company were Microsoft, Google,
Amazon. Well, there was a merger between the state and the private company like Microsoft, Amazon, I guess.
Microsoft, they were telling you and me that they were encrypting your Outlook, and at the same time, they were giving the keys to decrypt to the NSA.
Thanks, Bill.
Yes. So, but Europe was very weak because I haven't seen one single lawsuit against the GAFA. As a result of the Snowden revelations.
No, you know? Nothing happened.
Nothing happened. It's a very big sign of weakness because you, can you imagine the opposite? You know, if the Europeans were doing the same thing in the US, I think all the companies will be nailed. But.
So what was the CLOUD Act?
So since this was revealed to the world, the US decided in 2018 to enact the CLOUD Act. So what is the CLOUD Act? It basically, it says the following, that if a company stores its data in the cloud and that the service provider of the cloud is an American company, so Microsoft, Azure, Amazon, Google, and so on, then those American companies have the obligation to give you data to any requests coming from people in the US, like prosecutors and so on, if there is a request from the Department of Justice or from whoever.
It's crazy.
Okay. And not only they have the obligation to do it, but they have the obligation also not to tell you that they're doing it.
Okay.
Okay. So even if the servers are located, for instance, in France, or
if it's an American company, it's...
as long as the American service provider is an American company. So basically, with the Cloud Act, my views have done two things. One, they have legalized economic espionage by the GAFA.
Yes.
Two, they have given legal protection to the GAFA.
Yes.
By doing it.
Yes.
Okay. So, of course, you have a lot of people who are going to tell you, yes, but a prosecutor needs the first that a judge decides.
Well, you have an experience to say what happens.
Not only have the experience, but as I said, I'm an engineer, so I've looked at the details. And for instance, I've looked at, I don't remember which period in Connecticut, every time a prosecutor was asking a judge to do this kind of thing, out of 200,000 requests, only 5 or 10 were rejected by the judge. So in fact, the judge in the US right now, that's one of the big problems in the US, is that the judge are no longer part of the judicial system.
Mm-hmm.
Because all the things are negotiated between the prosecutor and the company, or between the prosecutor and
the lawyers
and the lawyer of the people. And it's a negotiated justice. And there's no more trial, or very, very few trial. For instance, in my case, at the end of the day, it lasted more than 5 years. I've never seen a judge in 5 years. I saw the judge only 20 minutes during my sentencing at the last minute. And even this, I was not even able to say my side of the story. In 5 years, I was never allowed to say my side of the story.
Okay. So it basically means, like I told you before we were recording, like during this lockdown and COVID-19, there's special financial aid and support for French companies located in France that have no activities, mm-hmm. for most of them, no activities outside of France. And to have this financial help, they have to provide with their paperwork, mm-hmm. Accounting, documentation, etc. And now we know it's all been in the cloud, Amazon cloud.
Yeah.
So basically it means that all these companies, in theory at least, or not even in theory, are subjected to the Cloud Act.
Yes. And one of the biggest scandals in France in the last few months has been what we call the health data hub. Because in France, all your medical information mm-hmm. are now stored in what we call a health data hub.
Microsoft.
And in fact, they have decided to select Microsoft to basically house all the medical files of all the French citizens. So now it's a big, big scandal because mm-hmm. Microsoft is basically under the Cloud Act. That's one thing. And second thing is that in Europe, we have we had in July 2020. What we call the Schrems II decision by the European Commission.
Mm-hmm.
And the Schrems II decision basically forbids the transfer of personal data from Europe to the US.
Mm-hmm.
You can read the decision by the European Court of Justice. Basically, they say because the US cannot guarantee that the personal data will not be used by the Secret Service, basically, on the other side. And it's a very interesting decision because it's the first time where...
When was it?
July 2020.
Okay, so it's 6 months time. Okay.
6 months time. So after that decision, you know, basically, those companies are not allowed to transfer personal data. And therefore, it creates a big legal problem for them. But at least it's one kind of protection.
It's the beginning of a
response. But the funny thing is that it doesn't come from the States. It comes from one guy called Mr. Schrems, who is a lawyer in Austria, who decided to fight his case against, at that time, Facebook, and won the case, and therefore created this this new law. Because before that, the European states had negotiated with the US what we call the Privacy Shield, which was an agreement after the Snowden scandal to continue to transfer data. And this agreement, the Privacy Shield, was not seen as being secured enough to protect the interest of European citizens. So therefore, this guy, Mr. Schrems, decided to attack this negotiated agreement between Europe and the US, and he won. So what you see is that it's very often, you know, individuals who make things change. Well, more than government, because of course you have vested interest sometimes to not to alienate your so-called friends on the other side of the Atlantic, you know. Mm-hmm. So the Cloud Act is the next step of extraterritoriality, and it's not the only one. Every year or 2 years, you have a new law trying to be imposed on everybody. So now, who's reacting? So France is starting to react but we had to wait the Alstom case to react. UK reacted as well. They created their own law to protect the British companies, because also the US was attacking British companies. And of course, the one who are reacting the most is the Chinese and the Russians, because they are creating their own system with the alternative payment to the SWIFT system in order to not to be linked with the dollar anymore. And they're trying to de-Americanize all the internet as well, and all the computers by using domestic products instead and software instead of American software.
Which may explain the rush that we're seeing right now to modify our means of exchange with cryptocurrency and trying to keep the dollar system, as Catherine says, trying to prolong the dollar system as much as possible while implementing a new crypto currency system, which she says is not a currency at all.
Yes.
It's a means of exchange with basically, you know, what everybody is doing with...
You see different fronts. I mean, on the technology side, you also see on the big fight on the 5G. You've seen that... The Department of Justice have indicted the CFO of Huawei in Canada and asking her to be extradited to the U.S., which created a big fight between Canada and China, and also between U.S. And China. Of course, behind this, you have the fight to control the 5G, because Huawei was much more advanced than anybody else in the world on this. And the interesting thing, at least during the Trump presidency, is that everything was put to
on hold.
Not on hold, but he was basically saying aloud what Obama was doing anyway, but not saying it.
Okay, it was
because basically,
clear.
If you look at the FCPA, you know, the big increase of fines and the use of the FCPA as an economic weapon was done under Obama, you know, years. But of course, it was always it never admitted. By the US government, they were doing it. Under Trump, you know, he had no barrier. Okay, so for instance, in the Huawei case, he declared that if he could do a commercial deal between China and the US, he would do something for the CFO of indicted by the Department of Justice. So here you have a different direct link between executive power and the Department of Justice. Basically, he's telling you, Department of Justice is my arm, I'm doing whatever I want with it. It was even more obvious when William Barr, so the head of the Department of Justice, after having put a fine of $1 billion to Ericsson, the European competitor on 5G, declared that US should buy either Nokia or Ericsson in order to be able to control the 5G. So, can you imagine a European Minister of Justice saying something similar? But, you know, for instance, do you imagine the French Minister of Justice saying, okay, we should buy this and this company for the national interest? which is not his job, the Minister of Justice, you know. But in the US, not joking, but the Minister of Justice is saying that, okay, I'm using my my power in order to squeeze people to sell their company.
And you're making the company pay for the buying.
Yes, and you make the company pay for the buying.
That dates back from the 80s with the LBO
yes.
as well. Okay.
So maybe as a final word, what I would say is that I got a lot of support from in the US, actually, because when the book was translated in the US, I got a lot of letters from lawyers mm-hmm. and from judges mm-hmm. And from professors of law and so on and so mm-hmm. forth. Because what we've seen in the last 15 years is that the U.S. system has derived completely, you know, basically since 9/11, you know, and the Patriot Act. We see that lawyers have lost their job because they go to school. What they were writing to me, basically, they go to school in order to learn the law and to defend whoever they need to defend. Now, their new job is no longer to defend. Their new job is to negotiate with the prosecutor. Mm-hmm. They're not negotiators.
No.
They're not supposed to be negotiators. But now, basically, their main job is just to negotiate with the Department of Justice prosecutor. So a lot of them have lost
Their motivation,
because it's no longer what they were.
Well, they're sellers. I like I like to sell things, but I guess it's not their job. Lawyers shouldn't be doing that all the time.
Right. Second thing is that judges are no longer in the process. Basically, they become what we call
rubber stamp
judges. Basically, they just put a stamp on what has been negotiated between the prosecutor and the company, or between the prosecutor and the people. Mm-hmm. So they have lost also most of them their power or their function. So you are now in a world of super prosecutor by the Department of Justice, who basically have their own motivation to do things, and their motivation is not to find the truth. Their motivation is to win their cases.
I'd like to ask you a final question and then we'll wrap it up. Is there a time maybe in French or European history that will be comparable to, or in more ancient time, comparable to the days we're living now?
Well, as I said, every country who has usually a military advantage over the rest of the world will try to impose its law. You know, the Romans imposed their law to all of Europe, you know, because they had the military power. On the French side, we had Napoleon, who also imposed the Napoleonic code, you know, everywhere he went, you know, still in place in a lot of countries. So, on one side, I understand, okay, U.S. have the military power, so they try to impose their law everywhere, and it's logical. Mm-hmm. What is not logical is that the European, don't react or react too softly to this. Because if we continue to go the way we're going, basically we are becoming annexed to the U.S., and we're going to be squeezed between the U.S. and China, and we are not going to be able to find our third route. Mm-hmm. It's a choice. My view is that we need to turn the page of Second World War. I think we have not finished the Second World War. Mm-hmm. We still have NATO in Europe. We still have military power in a lot of U.S. military bases in a lot of countries. We are still saying that Russia is a big threat, even though there's no chance they can do much damage, you know. But we keep this constant pressure on European countries and with this military umbrella. And until we recover our sovereignty on the military side, it's going to be difficult to recover our sovereignty on the legal side, on the industrial side, on the numerical side as well.
Okay, thank you, Frédéric,